The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show.
On Relevant Radio.
We were saying goodbye to Grandma.
Grandma Sheila Lewis was in a coma for 6 weeks due to a rare medical condition. The former daycare provider was totally unresponsive and on life support. Even doctors at the world-renowned Mayo Clinic said there was nothing more they could do.
I don't know if my heart could break anymore.
Her family brought her home to die. 12 days off life support, no food or water. Sheila's 8 grandkids saying their goodbyes when stubborn Sheila changed their plans.
She woke up saying, help me and water.
We looked at each other like a deer in the headlights. Did we just hear her voice?
The grandma they were getting ready to live without was instead getting better.
She's an absolute miracle.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Don't you love that? Look, we're not the authors of life. We're not in control of life. We don't determine when it ends. God does. 2 years ago, that woman, a woman named Sheila Lewis, she was in a coma for 6 weeks. Can you imagine that? I can't imagine somebody I love being in a coma for a month and a half. Totally unresponsive. Needed life support in order to be able to exist. Her family brought her home to die. But instead, God had another plan. She woke up and was recovered. You know, years ago, when I first joined Relevant Radio, I did my first broadcast in August of 2004. And soon afterwards, in the months that followed, I would cover what became a national story. I was one of the few broadcasters on the very front end of the story. It was a story of Terri Schiavo. You know her story very well. What a tragedy that was. And the world responded, you know, and I thought, will we ever see something like this happen again? Unfortunately, she was put to death by her husband, Michael Schiavo, and I had the opportunity to get to meet a guy named Bobby Schindler and his family. Bobby's been a champion for those who don't have a voice, you know, especially trying to raise awareness to the end-of-life issues and to those who are cognitively disabled, those who are challenged and are being put to death. And I thought of him the other day when I came across a story. I shared it with you briefly. I told you the story about Archie Battersby. He's a 12-year-old kid, right? He's in Britain. And they found him unconscious, you know, back in April. He had a ligature around his neck. The speculation is that he had maybe given into some kind of social media, you know, blackout challenge. There's a lot of this wacky stuff online, and God protect our kids, right? So his parents take him to the hospital. They put him on life support. And soon after that, the hospital says, nah, it doesn't look good. We want to remove him from life support. And the parents said, no, we don't want to take him off life support. It's our child. We want to do everything we can to keep him alive. And they went to court over the whole issue. And the case went then to the high court, and the family even wanted to appeal to the European Court of Human Rights, but they were denied that opportunity. British courts seem to be operating under some kind of misguided compassion, is the word maybe I should use, because each one ruled against the family. And you know why? Their logic, their rationale was that this little 12-year-old boy should be allowed to die in peace. They should be allowed to die in peace. So doctors at the Royal London Hospital, they argued that, you know, Archie was brain stem dead. He should be allowed to die. And to me, those words, brain stem dead, and then being allowed to die is completely illogical. But, you know, if that's not, I don't know what it is. But anyway, Archie died on Monday. A family member said that he was doing all right after the medications were withdrawn, and he turned blue after the oxygen was withdrawn. And parents said they could see him suffocating. Now, I don't want to bring you down. I'm not telling you this story to depress you or fill you with anxiety. I mentioned the story Tuesday. A listener wrote to me after they heard me broadcasting about the story, and she says, Drew, I think this happens more than you think. It's happening a lot more than you think. You know, people are being taken off life support against their family's will. Imagine your spouse or your son or your daughter being taken off of life support against your will. And this woman mentioned the case of a girl named Andres Brenda in Los Angeles, who was hospitalized. She had COVID last year, and the hospital wanted to remove him from life support. They declared him brain dead too. And, you know, what's weird about these stories is, like, in the case of Andres, he's brain dead, but the family has him answering questions. I mean, how do you do that if you're brain dead? Like, he was nodding yes to questions about whether or not he wants to live and go home. He could even squeeze a loved one's finger so tight that it turned red. So the family, they got an extension in court. But guess what? The hospital won. So this tonight or today is really just a cautionary tale for you. I've invited Bobby Schindler to stop by. As you know, his sister Terry was starved to death. She was starved and dehydrated to death in 2005 after a major court case went to the Supreme Court in our own country. It even involved the president. I remember him leaving his vacation. There was a special session of Congress, I believe, that took place as well. He started a foundation called Terry Schiavo Life and Hope Network, and I hope you'll check it out. There's a lot of these stories going on right now, and if you're in a situation, you might want to contact him. You can find him at lifeandhope.com, and Bobby's here today to bring us up to speed. Bobby, good afternoon. Good to have you back.
Hey, Drew. Who would have thought we'd be still speaking after 17 years when you first are down there covering Terry's case? Incredible, huh?
It's insane. I thought after the case of your sister's death, as horrific as that was and as national as that was, that we would have learned some lessons from this. But over the years, you and I have spoken about other cases. I love your take on why three cases involving British boys over the last 5 years, they became news items here in the States. But the shutting off life support against the family's wishes, you know, it's not just happening there, it's happening here as well. How often is it going on? What do you know? How many cases have there been since 2005? It's a lot of questions. Choose to answer whatever you can, but I'd love your take on all this.
Sure. Well, I never imagined we'd be, having or handling so many of these cases over the years. We didn't know what to expect, Drew. And I'd just like to clarify, some of these cases that we talk about are different from Terry's case, where Terry was, and you had alluded to that, Terry was only being sustained by food and hydration through a feeding tube because of her difficulty swallowing. And we deal with a lot of those cases as well. But the cases that you were mentioning, the Archie case, and some of the others, the Charlie Gard, the Alfie Evans, they were being supported by ventilators. So that type of treatment is a little different. You can handle those. They're ethically, they could be handled differently than when we talk about a situation like Terry's. But the parents do. They have every right to continue care if that's what they want to do, and they were denied in those cases. And it's interesting, Drew, I look at these cases, the Archer case, and the Europeans still seem to make these type of cases they get a lot of national attention, and they make their way over here in America. And I think that gives Americans kind of they think, well, it's happening over there. If it's getting all this news, if it was happening here, it would be getting the same type of news coverage. And that's just not the fact, because those types of cases that we're seeing with Archie are happening every single day. And you mentioned, ironically enough, or sadly enough, Drew, we had a case just today. We had a mother contact us on August 4th. Her daughter, 17 years old, Drew, 2 days before had an asthma attack and ended up in the hospital. Doctors, within 2 days, diagnosed her as being brain dead and moved to remove her life-sustaining treatment. The mother contacted us.
Wow.
We connected her with an attorney right away. The attorney was able to get a TRO and extend this girl's life. From Friday, last Friday, this was just last Friday, and they gave the hospital, the judge gave the family, my understanding, until today to find another facility for transfer.
Wow.
The mother was unable to find a facility, and sadly, her life support was removed, and she died today, Drew. This was after a very short period of time, and what's even more upsetting and sad is she had six siblings. They were all around their daughter, and they were trying to do everything they could to stimulate her, and they really felt that she was starting to respond to the stimulation, to the family, encouraging her to wake up and doing all types of those types of stimulation techniques to try and help her, because the clock was ticking, because the hospital was getting aggressive on moving her life support. And it's just so sad that these decisions are made in such a short and quick period of time, Drew, without giving these individuals the chance to see if they can respond to treatment.
That's so true. My guest today, Bobby Schindler, brother of Terry Schiavo, and Maybe you're going through a crisis right now. Maybe there's a case you're dealing with. If you'd love to talk to Bobby, if you want some insight, maybe there's something you've gone through, feel free to dial in. The number here is 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Love to talk with you. You know, I look at these stories, and I often think that, you know, the way the courts look at this, and help me better understand it, as I said in the case of Archie and others, they almost see it as compassionate for the person that is in that particularly compromised state. And you can understand, you know, the parents not wanting to let their loved one go. Are they doing this out of a misguided form of compassion for the person who needs the life support? Or is it about economics? Is it really about money and they just don't want to continue to spend the money, occupy that hospital bed to keep somebody in a state like this alive? Do they not see the dignity of the life itself, and they see this person more as a dollar sign?
I think you're spot on, Drew. I think it's both, really. I think we're being taught or told that suffering is a bad thing, and we must do everything we can to eliminate it, especially when it comes to you know, people like my sister. I heard it all the time. Let her die with dignity. She's suffering, which was all untrue. But yeah, I think you're right. I think we look at these individuals and we've convinced others that it's in their best interest to end their so-called suffering. And I also think a big component, too, is it's cost-driven. When you look at someone who has a serious brain injury and you look at a long-term treatment and what it might cost compared to the cost of ending that person's life, you know, within a few days or a week, I mean, for the hospital, that's a lot of money saved. So, yes, I think that's a big part of the decision-making process, and it's a cost containment. Look, Drew, when you have government controlling your healthcare system, mm-hmm. if you have more and more of government making these types of decisions and setting policies, well, if government controls healthcare. Yeah. They're going to control decisions, and when you have families that don't have the means or the funds or the insurance, and they depend on the government to care, you know, to provide them the resources to treat their loved ones, well, they're in control of making these treatment decisions. Yeah, and there's not much you can do fight it.
I think about that. I think about the public funds behind a lot of this. A lot of patients rely on public funds, either Medicare or Medicaid, and that should not make a difference on how they're treated. But I think you're right. I think, unfortunately, it does, and hopefully this is a wake-up call for those who are listening. Let me grab a few calls for you, Bobby. I know I only have you for about another 15 minutes or so, and time tends to fly here. We'll go to Marcella. She's listening in Austin, Texas, and wants to share something with you. Hi, Marcella, you're on the air with Bobby Schindler.
Hi. I just wanted to touch base, too, that there's a serious issue on the extreme end of life for the elderly. We have a situation. My mom was in the hospital. She had had a heart attack, and she does have major occlusions to the heart that are blocked, mm-hmm. and she was intubated, but was able to be extubated. They decided that she couldn't do surgery, and so instead of helping her get better, they were dumping her in different areas of the hospital. Like, they quickly, as soon as she was able to do a little bit of sitting up, she still had a catheter, couldn't walk. You know, and I'm seeing them in ICU with physical therapy helping other patients, but they moved my mom. They wanted to move her like at midnight, right? And then they dumped her in an area of the hospital that didn't even barely have staff. It was slated for closure. They kept moving her to areas of the hospital, and we had to fight every step of the way for her care. And then I was reading that through Obamacare, I don't remember the name of the law, but mm-hmm. that hospitals aren't fined if a patient is released from a hospital and dies within a certain amount of months of time. However, if they send them to hospice, the hospital makes money. And so they were pushing palliative care on us, like, wow, within days, without really even giving her a chance. And I'm thinking they kept moving her in the hospital thinking that she was going to die. They didn't expect that she would make it and recover. I mean, we have to push for a lot of help and services for her.
Marcella, thank you. Let me let Bobby respond. Bobby, do you hear a lot of stories like that?
Oh, all types of stories. And it's heart-wrenching when you get these stories and you hear these families trying to get treatment and care for their loved ones. And sometimes it's extremely difficult, and we use all the resources we can to try and help these families. But I think it also illustrates the call, Drew, the importance and necessity today of appointing a healthcare agent, someone who's going to step in and advocate for you if you ever do become in these situations where you need someone to advocate you. I think we need to move away from advance directives. Advance directives, I think, play in the hands with the language, the subjective language, plays in the hands of the hospitals and doctors making decisions. Having a healthcare agent to stand in and fight for you and make sure you get the treatment you need and want is a much better alternative today, especially in today's healthcare.
That's well said. Marcella, thank you for your call. Sorry for what you had to go through. Sue, who's waiting to join us, Bobby's listening in Wisconsin. Sue, good afternoon.
Hi, Bobby. I want to thank you so much for your center, because I had a problem with my parent who had a feeding tube in through for a long period of time, for over a year and a half, with no issues, gained weight, was doing well. They declared him in a vegetative state and he didn't have quote-unquote quality of life. And I said, that's not true. My parent responds to me. They were going to take the feeding tube out. They gave us one day did all this legal stuff, and I didn't know what to do. We didn't have an attorney. So I called the Diocese of La Crosse. They gave me your number and the BioLife Center. I immediately got a call from one of your attorneys saying, are they trying to take this out on a holiday? Because that's what we see happen all the time, so you can't get an attorney. Your attorney, I looked in Minnesota, Wisconsin, everywhere, and through you guys, I was able to get an attorney who did this through you and was able to find one legal thing after another they did, fought. But I will tell you, this is what the legal people said. We don't know what your parents' Catholic or Christian faith has to do with whether or not they have a feeding tube or alive or dead or not. What does that have to do with their health care, caring about life and their faith? This stuff is my passion, and I have told hundreds of people about this, and I have had dozens and dozens of people tell me this is exactly what happened to them. My parent had it in the legal documents to not have to have a feeding tube and to be kept alive. A perfect, healthy body, just not a healthy mind. There was nothing wrong with the heart, lungs, blood pressure, nothing. Perfect skin. And yet they said, terrible quality of life. That wasn't their decision to make. And as a person of faith, to see legal people have no consideration of that at all. We have got to have legislation, Bobby, in Congress and in the Senate and in our state houses that is much clearer, much better, and much more educating to the public, because this has happened to dozens of people, and it is disgusting. It is absolutely death panels, and they wanted my parent dead for money. Absolutely, positively true.
Well, God bless you, and we hear so many, and I'm glad the attorneys were able to help. I mean, that's what we're here to do, to help families, connect them with the resources to fight against these types of situations. You know, Drew, over the years, what's happened, there's been a lot of changes in hospital policies and in how medical definitions, so to speak. For example, feeding tubes were once considered ordinary and basic care. Today they're considered life-sustaining treatment, artificial life support, medical treatment. And these subtle changes, or maybe not so subtle, have really opened up the floodgates, as they say, to make it easier to stop treatment. In fact, it's now legal in all 50 states to remove or deny someone fluid hydration through a feeding tube, if that's their decision. Even if the person has expressed wishes, they want, as I think this young lady alluded to, even if they have expressed wishes, they want to receive fluid hydration through a feeding tube. But there's been so many changes in policy, unbeknownst to the public, that now is really removing many of our rights when it comes to medical treatment and putting it in the hands of hospitals, insurance companies, ethics committees. They're the ones making decisions now. And as we had mentioned earlier, a lot of it is based on cost and other reasons too. Mm-hmm. I think you know, we're becoming more and more of a godless type of many in the medical profession are no longer even align themselves with the Hippocratic Oath and don't look at someone, and I think you kind of mentioned this earlier, each person, each patient as having the value and dignity and be treated as such. So, yeah, we have a lot of problems in healthcare today, and it's going to be difficult moving forward to correct a lot of these problems. But as I mentioned earlier, that's why it's so important, I think, that we need advocates that are going to fight for us, especially our family members if we're in these situations.
Sue, thank you. Thank you very much for your call. Great comments there. My guest today is Bobby Schindler, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about hospitals cutting off life support against families' wishes and really much more. Several stories have come across my radar, and I just thought I'd bring this before you. You might find yourself in this situation. Maybe you're there right now. Let's go to Tijeras, New Mexico. Elizabeth is waiting to join the conversation. Hi, Elizabeth, you're on the air with Bobby Schindler.
Hi, thank you. I am a registered dietitian who has worked in long-term care for over 40 years. I have noticed in the last 14 years, but especially in the last 5 years, a trend where these cases don't even go to the lawyer or really go to the family or to the person's desired wishes. But I've been seeing tube feedings that I have recommended that we increase the fluids, that we do things to help with the physical and mental status that comes from dehydration and starvation. And I will have nurses turn around, even after the doctors have agreed with me, turn around, call other family members, call other doctors, and get those tube feedings discontinued. And I have heard the same problem from a couple of my other fellow dietitians in different homes. And I'm bringing this forward because there doesn't seem to be a legal way to stop this. I mean, sometimes I've left on a Friday evening thinking I've gotten the person all fed and ready to go, and 2 hours later someone has convinced someone else to turn off the tube feeding.
Wow. All right, Bobby, I'll let you respond.
Sadly, I think you're right as far as trying to stop this, at least legally. A lot of families don't know that they can fight back. They can question doctors, the decisions. They can ask for second opinions. And a lot of families just, their impulse is to agree with doctors and do what they say. Mm-hmm. But if you have reasons to think that what is happening should be at least questioned, or if you have questions, you have every right to do that. But you're right. Families are, we get these types of calls all the time, and they can be very difficult. And I also add, a lot of these situations medically are case by, well, they are. I mean, they're all case by case based. They're all case by case. You have to evaluate them. There are situations where it might be appropriate to stop someone's food and hydration. It might be appropriate, or it's morally, it's ethically permittable to stop someone's life-sustaining treatment, whether that might be a ventilator. But they're all case-by-case basis, and you have to evaluate them that way. You can't just make a blatant statement and say, you know, whatever it is, if it's been 2 weeks and you're still on life-sustaining treatment, it should be stopped, or whatever the situation. It really depends on medically what's going on.
Well, Elizabeth, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. I have Bobby for a few minutes. I just want to sneak another call in here from California. This is Teresa, she's got a pretty amazing story for you, Bobby. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. And I just want to thank Bobby for everything he's done. And he and I have met some years ago. I've been speaking out against the false brain death diagnosis. And then to my chagrin, I guess, horror, my cousin's granddaughter who was in her mid-20s, or is, I should say, in her mid-20s. She was in a pretty bad car crash, had left side of her skull crushed, and she was pronounced brain dead. I don't know how the family was able to keep her on life support for 2 weeks, but I can tell you we prayed a lot. And they ultimately said, nope, there's no activity. We're taking her to the operating room. She's an organ donor. She wanted to be an organ donor. You know, that's where she's going. They took her there, and with that state, I guess their criteria, and it's not true here in California, I just want to make that clear, but their criteria there apparently is to have the surgeons in the operating room remove the breathing tube, and then wait for the person to stop breathing. Their criteria was to wait up to 90 minutes for her to stop breathing. She did not stop breathing, so she was sent back to the intensive care unit. They did not reintubate her or do any sort of treatment after that. They sent her back to die. Well, after 2 days, she was still breathing, so they sent her home to die. She was home just for hours, and she woke up. She was able to move her arm. She was able to speak some. They were told to bring her back to the trauma center. She saw the doctor, I don't know which doctor, I presume a neurologist, came into the emergency room, and she looked over at him and said, "Hi." And he literally jumped out of his skin. Wow. So flash forward, she ended up celebrating the Thanksgiving that she missed. I believe it was in April. She's in the Midwest. I'm here in California. She's now in horse therapy. She's at home. She's talking. She has her memories. She had her skull repaired before she was sent home. So they do not give these patients time for the brain swelling to go down. It was a miracle, in my estimation, that she was left on life support for 2 weeks.
Well, Teresa, I only have about a moment or two left. Thank you, first of all, for sharing that story. Bobby, I'd love to get your thoughts and some final thoughts for all who are listening. If they're in a similar situation, what can they do? Where can they find resources? How can they get help?
Sure. I just wanted just a quick comment. That's an incredible story. But we're getting, Drew, I got to tell you, we're getting more and more calls with brain death situations where families are being told in a very short period of time that their loved one has been diagnosed brain death. And I think much of it is connected into the organ donation program. There's not enough time to talk about this, but we are seeing an increase in calls in these brain death situations. And they're made so quickly. So oftentimes we're just an arbiter of time. We try to help the family just get time to see if, in fact, they can find some way to get their loved one treated before their lives are ended. But you can reach us, Drew. And thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. It's lifeandhope.com. I urge any family, if they are in a crisis, to give us a call, and we'll do our best to try and help you as best we can. We've been pretty successful over the years helping families at least get the support they need to see if, in fact, they can somehow help out their loved ones. So please keep us in mind if you're ever confronted with these types of situations.
Well, Bobby, keep up your good work. All right, brother. It's been a long time, and you've been in the battle for quite a while. I know that you're changing lives, and I'm grateful to have you here. And well, hopefully, you know, have our paths cross again soon. But I'm going to post on Twitter your link for anyone who needs it, and hopefully they'll check it all out. Have a great one, okay?
Sure. Anytime, Drew. I'd love to come on. It's Bobby S. Schindler, Bobby S. Schindler at Twitter. And it's also, go to our Facebook page. It's Terry Shiver, Life and Hope Network Facebook page. Either warrior, and then you can our website. You can contact us through our website as well.
So God bless you, Drew. Really God bless you. Follow him on Twitter. Follow him on Facebook. Check out the website, lifeandhope.com. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
So beginning in March 2020, we had somewhere around 50 million U.S. K-12 students displaced from their classrooms.
Over the past year, these school closures have led to substantial losses for children, millions of children all across the country, academically, socially, mentally, physically.
We're going to continue to see an uptick in the number of families choosing to take their kids out of district schools or to not enroll them from the beginning if they are, say, entering pre-K or kindergarten. The data around youth mental health has really been harmed due to the lockdowns and the pandemic policy over the past year, mainly due to isolation of kids.
In Clark County Public Schools, the fifth largest school district in the nation, a doubling of student suicides relative to the previous school year.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that is, that's frightening. For the first time, really in modern U.S. history, a mass exodus from traditional public schools, from our school system there. I don't know where your kids go to school, maybe where you're planning on sending them, maybe where your education was, but we are having a problem. I know we're getting ready to go back to school. In fact, I can't believe the time goes. It goes so quick. In fact, I think schools already started in some parts of the country, but public school districts are facing some real challenges today, namely the loss of students and teachers. You know, the New York Times, they reported recently that New York City school enrollment, it fell by about 50,000. The state of Michigan, similar drop. California's public school enrollment, they're down 250,000. You take a look at Chicago, their public schools are closing. They're closing public school buildings because there aren't enough kids being signed up in the classes. And according to the Washington Post, it's not just kids who aren't going, but it's the teachers as well. And I look at these states, I think of California, I think of New York, I think of Michigan, some of these places, very liberal, right, with their policy. You see what our kids are being indoctrinated with. One school administration organization told the paper, the article I was reading, this is a shortage that has never been as bad as it is right now. It has never been as bad as it is right now. I saw reports earlier today about the police, too. I mean, we're having a crisis in law enforcement. Men aren't signing up for it. There's a deficit for it. The police officers are retiring at record numbers. Take a look at our educational system. Do you see a thread that runs through all this? Can you kind of see what happens? Let me ask you, what's going on? How do you read it? What do you see? What do you think is behind these numbers? You know, the whole idea of a free, publicly subsidized education, you know, in fact, mandated education, it's been a cornerstone of the American nation since probably around the mid-19th century. The whole idea was that, you know, we couldn't have a thriving democratic republic without an educated citizenry. And I believe that. I'm with you. I stand behind that principle. I think we need good education. And the roots of it goes all the way back to Catholicism, believe it or not. Catholic nuns who started schools in various places around the country, even educating, you know, blacks and other minorities at the time. Protestant and others, you know, Protestants and number of other groups at the time, they didn't like the idea of Catholics educating children because they'd get kind of popish, if you will. You know, the idea, you know, they get those popish ideas. So what did they do? They got states to start schools paid by the taxpayer. And that's why there was prayer in public schools up until the 1950s when the Supreme Court ruled that, can't do that. It's illegal. And since then, look, we know a lot has changed, right? COVID hit, parents started actually seeing what's going on in the classroom, you know, thanks to Zoom. They were infuriated. They started showing up at school board meetings in droves so much that the Justice Department started to target parents as domestic terrorists, right? Is that not crazy? So what happened? Parents said, okay, you want to play that game? They ended up going to the voting booth. You saw what happened in Virginia. Parents are voting with their pocketbooks. Right? They're putting into office people that reflect their views. And they're also leaving the schools or saying, no problem. You're going to indoctrinate our kids. You're going to treat us this way. We're out of here. And they take their kids with them. This is really a big story. And it's one I think we need to talk about. Public school enrollment in decline. Noelle Mehring is a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. And you can check out her book. She wrote one called Awake, Not Woke, A Christian Response to the cult of progressive ideology. Tan publishes that. You can also follow her at theologyofhome.com. She joins me once again. It's always good to have you on the air with me, Noelle. Thanks for a rational voice.
Hi, Drew. Great to be with you.
Yeah, this is a pretty telling story, and I think people need to be aware of what's happening here. These trends are continuing, and they're going to have long-ranging, I think, impact on the country. Let's start talking a little bit about these woke parents. I mean that in a good sense. Like, what woke parents up, if you will, to what's going on in public schools? I mean, we're indoctrinating our kids with wokeism, and parents are saying, I'm not going to buy that. You know what? You woke me up. And they're saying enough's enough. I know Teresa Farnon, and Mary Rice Hasson, they wrote a book called Get Out Now a couple years before COVID, telling people to get out of public schools. Since then, we've really seen a groundswell. But I'd love your thoughts.
Yeah, I think the parents are becoming awake, not woke, you might say.
Right.
We're living in fascinating times. You know, I think we're witnessing a massive reevaluation of how we are to live our lives on the grassroots level. We're seeing mass exodus, as you say, of the public schools, but also of cities and very progressive states. And there's multiple reasons. I mean, I think oftentimes people want to oversimplify it and say, well, now we can work remotely, and so we can reevaluate. Well, that might be a piece of it, but there's another huge elephant in the room, which is that there's been a massive disintegration of cities into violence, lawlessness over the past few years, but also a growing sense of total institutional failure and corruption on various levels. And the school systems are reflecting that. I think people have recognized their kids are not being formed. They're being deformed oftentimes by the educational system, and they're saying, enough, we want out.
Yeah, my guest, Noelle Merring, if you want to join me, too, we only have a few minutes left in the broadcast today, maybe share your own experience. Love to hear it. It's 888-914-9149. You can get in on the conversation. You know, the state of Minnesota is considering a rule, Noelle, that will require anyone seeking, let's say, a teacher's license, that you have to subscribe to this whole liberal agenda. I never heard of anything like this. There was a woman, I think her name was Frieda Baldwin. She was so incensed at this. She started her own private school in what was a predominantly black neighborhood in Minneapolis. And it made me think, are we going to start to see more of this, more school, independent schools popping up, more people homeschooling, more Catholic or Christian schools or charter schools? For the state of Minnesota to say you got to subscribe to this liberal agenda or we're not going to give you a license, I was shocked. I never heard anything like that. But your thoughts?
Right. That type of coercion is how they disseminate the ideology, and they really weed out the well-intentioned, excellent teachers that want to be do working for the good. And that's why we see so many teachers leaving in large part. Parents in schools, they used to be in partnership, both with the good of the child in mind. Now they've become antagonists, where the schools are hiding things from the parents. They don't want the parents to know that their kids are regendering themselves, and so they keep, these secrets from the parents. In other words, the goal used to be critical thinking. Now it's critical theory, critical race theory and queer theory. These are really, the point is to turn the kids ultimately against the parental influence, to separate that bond and that connection. And we see this anecdotally left and right. I'm hearing from parents and grandparents all over the country who said, my kids hate me now. They got woke and now they can't stand what I stand for and what I've handed down to them. And it sounds alarming, but what else can explain the insanity that we're seeing with drag queens and gender ideology introduced at the youngest of ages, all the way down to 5 years old, and also what you're indicating in your opening monologue? I mean, these things beggar belief, and they really cry out for explanation, and there's real explanation to be had if we read the literature. There's a revolutionary ideology that has been seeded throughout the educational system for decades, and we're seeing the fruits of it now.
Yeah. My guest today, Noelle Merring. Noelle, stay with me for a quick second. I'm going to take a short pause. Katie in Naperville, Illinois, we'll get you on the air, and everyone else, we'll grab your calls. Final segment of the Drew Mariani Show straight ahead. We are taking a look at a crisis in our country. Our public school enrollment is shrinking. Number of reasons for why. So what is the alternative if we don't get this right? What does it portend for the future? Giving you a look at life you won't find anywhere else. Feel free to join me. 888-914-9149. I'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
We've been at these school board meetings. We've been voicing our opinions. We're writing articles. We're emailing teachers. We're doing all that stuff, and they don't care. So I'm like, the only thing left to do is to just peace out.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that was a concerned mom. Her name was Keisha King. She spoke at a Family Research Council forum about how parents have tried everything they can to change things in their local school. And I think that's your first step. You know, I don't think you just abandon the school. I think you need to let your voice be heard, point out your concerns, try to make a change, volunteer for the school board if you can. But what Keisha found is that the school boards, the administration, didn't care. She was just some whiny parent, you know, complaining about the kids' education, you know. And she's not part of that liberal agenda. I'm joined today by Noel Mehring. And if you're just joining us, we were talking a little bit about declining public school enrollment. It's shrinking in New York and in Michigan. It's down in California and a lot of other states. And we're looking at the reason why. And Noel, let's jump into the phones. We got a lot of people who will want to share their experience with you. And I want to go to Naperville, Illinois first. Katie's been waiting, I think, the longest. Katie, hi. You're on the air with Noel Mehring.
Hi. I'm a parent of four kids, and we never set out to have our kids in public school. But over the years, we determined that they have special needs that the Catholic schools couldn't meet. So, you know, we're kind of trapped in the public school system at this point, and we would love to be able to return our kids to Catholic schools, but we just did not have a good experience with it at the time. Yeah. And I just really would love to see some progress made on the Catholic school front of being able to respond to some of the special needs students, and I wanted to know what your thoughts were on those.
And no, I'll respond. Yep. I just want to say that's such a valid point. My frustration with Catholic schools, and I had the privilege of sending my kids there, I mean, cost is prohibitive to a lot of parents. And also, as Katie pointed out, Noel, these special needs, how can the Catholic school education better bridge the gap?
You know, that's a great question. I understand that would be enormously difficult because you have to tend to those needs. You know, my encouragement to you would be that, you know, you sound like an involved, intentional parent. The more social activity they can have with like-minded families, even if it has to be outside of school, I'm sure there are some in the school as well, but the more, you know, really wholesome environments you can put them in so they can have peer support, because that's going to be a really crucial thing as they get older. And I think also I would talk to them pretty openly about the ways that there are kind of ideological indoctrination tactics, just not to make them paranoid, but to just make them encouraged and emboldened to kind of know that they can say no to that and that they don't have to become prey to it. I'd also be really careful with media, social media, all of that. I mean, I think there's ways to do it, and great kids make it through the public schools for certain. I'll pray for you as well that works out well for your family.
Katie, thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
You got it. We'll go to Pamela next in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hi, Pamela. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you. I appreciate you taking my call. Noel, thank you for your book. I have read it, found it to be very informative. I do have some positive news and then also a comment, too, to the last caller. I'm the director for the Institute for Catholic School Leadership at the St. Paul Seminary and in the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis. And the positive news is that a lot of this exodus, in all of this, we have seen growth in our enrollment in Catholic schools in our archdiocese. And it is exciting to see the wonderful families that are now looking at Catholic schools, many of them for the first time, and finding them to be a better alternative for their families. And also, we have seen in our program, the Institute for Catholic School Leadership, we have seen teachers and school leaders who are leaving the public school system and are moving into our Catholic schools. They recognize they need some formation and training. But we are getting excellent talent
into our Catholic schools as a result. So there is some hope to this. I also want to encourage the parent who said with special needs, they find challenges within the Catholic school system. Very true. It is a reality, especially depending on the diocese in which you live. It is something that we are addressing at the Institute and within our archdiocese. But do know that there are programs available that Catholic schools can work with school, public school districts. Also, if you look at homeschooling, you can go to the Homeschool Legal Defense Association and work with specialists who are very familiar with all kinds of special needs, depending on what the needs are of your child. So I just want to encourage that parent, too, to consider that as an option. But lots of good news, too, for Catholic schools. It's an opportunity for Catholic schools. As long as Catholic schools stay committed to their mission and the vision and the identity of Catholic schools.
Catholic schools need to stay faithful. And this stuff can be in Catholic schools sometimes, too, so we have to be careful. But I agree with the caller that this is a time of real hope. I see it as a time of real hope. The Exodus, I think, is good news, that people are seeing what's happening and are striving for something better. And I think real good can come out of that.
Yeah, Pamela, thanks for what you're doing. Thanks for taking the time to call and to share that and for that advice. Maggie, could you open your microphone? Why don't you share the off-air caller's comment we just received? I want to run that by Noel as well. And I believe it came from a legislator's office. What's happening? And fill everyone in.
Yeah, Patrick just sent this note. He said... this caller called in, said they were a legislator. As a legislator in Minnesota, they might be changing standards for student testing. Good. They'll have to test to some radical standards, and this could even affect homeschooling as well.
Wow.
Yeah. That's not surprising. I mean, I think that as they start losing control because people start waking up to what's happening, the coercion is going to become increasingly exponential. And so that's not surprising at all. I mean, they're doing that in businesses and corporations. They're going to be doing that with schools. And I think with charter schools, too, that's a concern that as charter schools take public money, there'll be a whole host of strings attached that will keep growing. So we have to remain vigilant about all of that.
Yeah, I go back. Thank you for the legislator who called in and shared that. I just think as that person, you know, shared those comments, it's so important that we put into office and that we support those who are in office, who protect some of these very fundamental rights and who are not going to allow this, what I call craziness, to filter down to our kids who are malleable and so formative and so indoctrinatable. And, you know, this is a critical point for them. We as parents are the primary educators. We have to do our part. We also have to do our part in the voting, you know, in the voting booth. So my thanks to those who are in office who understand the gravity of their position and are willing to defend and protect our kids. Dee in California, you're on the air with Noelle Marion. Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon, Dee. Thank you.
Hey.
Yes, my comment is that it's not just public schools who are doing the woke agenda. It's also so-called Catholic schools, high schools, mm-hmm. That they've been run by LGBTQ directors. And yeah. So they doing the wokeness in those schools. So I believe the parents have to, you know, figure what is the curriculum take
responsibility
of the children education.
Dee, first of all, Dee, thank you for that comment because it's a good one and it really goes down to the essence of this. Look, we're talking about public schools and what's coming down, but there are a lot of other schools. You might send your kid to a charter school, it might be a Catholic school. I would hope it's the degree of wokeism is considerably less that's in there. But to her point, Noelle, what are we seeing in these other institutions? I know parents homeschool, but what about Catholic charter, private schools as well? How prevalent is this problem? Is this something we should be concerned about? And my final point to what she had to say is that it's really the parents' responsibility. You need to be aware of what's being taught, regardless of what institution they're in. But I'd like to get your take.
Yeah, no, that's right. I wrote an article with the National Catholic Register a while back about this happening in Catholic schools. And I think the parents had sort of felt that they could be, you know, really kind of, you know, just trustworthy at this institution. It's been a place they've been for years. And, I think we're kind of getting beyond that point. And they became aware of that fairly quickly. And so, I concur with what you're saying, that there's a vigilance required. We can't really just rest on our laurels and think that, you know, we can just send them to a place because it seems okay. We really need to be involved in what they're learning, who the teachers are, what the family and friend environment is. There's so many things that are really insidious now that I think are trying to invade our kids' worlds. And It's not to be defensive or paranoid, but it's just to be prudent, that we just have to know what's happening and be willing and courageous in the fight against it.
Love it. I only have a couple minutes left. Let me sneak Pam or Pat, listening in Minneapolis, in. Pat, hi. You're on the air with Noelle Mary.
Yes, hi. Well, I'm from Minnesota, and it's very frightening here. I am on a website, cplaction.com, talking about the new standards coming in. The judge is going to put them in August 24th, which is not that far away, teaching Marxist principles, critical race theory, sexual identity in all Minnesota schools, including early childhood, prenatal, as well as adult basic education, everything. Every licensed teacher in every school, including Catholic, private, whatever, is going to have to obtain this, get these standards of licensure. And if they're in teaching right now and not just training, this is training these teachers, they have to prove to get their license updated that they are, by provable, actually teaching this stuff. So they're getting down into the basics of the teacher education and the teacher training. They, all those teachers in Minnesota, as of August 24th, once that ruling goes through, are going to have to teach this stuff with no exceptions.
Thank you, Pat, for that comment. I'm going to let Noelle with the final thoughts, but Paul in Whittier has just left a message with our call screener. There's a school district. They're talking about building a Planned Parenthood at John Glenn High School. They're putting the vote off to July. So this is some wackiness. Final 30 seconds are yours, Noelle.
Yeah, I think the best thing that people can do is just to have clarity about what's happening, because this movement really operates on confusion and coercion. That's how it maintains its power. So the more clarity we have, the less we're going to fall for these tactics. It uses the method of force. It cannot further rely on goodwill and of dialogue. So it has to coerce people. It has to disseminate itself forcefully. And so we have to
Leave it right there, Noelle. My thanks. I'll be back tomorrow.